From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
All right, lads, hands across the ocean. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. How you going, fellas? I'm introducing Dallas, Texas, and with me in Australia is Stuart Box. Say hello, Stu.
Midnight Movie Cowboys. Jesus Christ.
Yes,
like
right.
Like the Care Bears. All right.
Midnight Movie Care Bears up in here. Why am I talking like I'm from South Central Los Angeles?
You don't. That would be another dialect altogether. You know what I'm saying?
I said up in here, though. Why'd I do that?
I'm sorry.
Brits don't say that.
No, they don't have their fucking pants around their ankles as well. Walking around Walmart.
Pretty much, my son. All right, and well, joining me in Rocky Mountain, Iowa, Colorado, we got Mr. Stuart Bulk. Say hello, Stu.
I'm in fucking Melbourne, you twat. He's in John's in Colorado.
That's what I said. I said John Grace.
No, you...
I don't know anymore.
Clearly, we're not doing the Lemmy. We're not doing the Lemmy documentary to dissuade anybody tuning out.
I can't do the Bob Hoskins screaming voice for too long. It doesn't really.
he was the only one of his kind.
He is rolling in his grave at a furious speed right now.
Yeah.
Shut up, you fucking idiot!
He's making the face he makes at the end of this movie right now. Yeah.
Where's Hunter?
The thing is, if you look at his career, it's funny how many roles he took from Danny DeVito and Danny DeVito took from him.
It's kind of like Harrison Ford and Tom Selleck or something.
Yeah, it is. Oh, yeah. It's crazy. It's like, if you read the history, it's nuts.
Like Super Mario Brothers, probably?
Yeah. He was offered Romancing the Stone before DeVito.
Oh, he did Super Mario Brothers, didn't he?
Yeah,
I don't think I've ever seen it.
I heard he was drunk on the set the whole time because he was like, this movie's going to be.
Yeah.
No, look up articles about the making of Super Mario Brothers. It's one of those troubled productions that's fascinating to read about.
Oh, the hell you say, really?
And of course, but the only person who's clearly having fun in that movie is Dennis Hopper.
Yeah, because he doesn't remember a damn thing about it, I bet.
Paid his booze bill.
Oh yeah. It's like an oddity. I shouldn't say always wanted to see. It's not like something I've wanted to seek out, but if it ever crossed my path, I'd be like, oh, I've got to at least try it out. I do remember seeing what's the new Super Mario show? They used to have Captain Lou Albano on it. That's right, yeah.
I watched that when I was a kid.
That was a head trip of a show to begin with. That was like...
Yeah. I know that existed.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Captain Lou Albano. There was the Super Mario Brothers Super Show.
That's it.
Captain Lou Albano hosted it as Super Mario. I can't remember who played Luigi, but it was a cartoon show. But
He doesn't want you to remember, Hunter, don't worry. He's hoping you'll forget.
I wasn't watching cartoons past, like, 1983.
Yeah, so. this was after... You would have been watching something like this.
I would have been sleeping in on Saturday mornings. So,
but no, we should add Super Mario Brothers to the spreadsheet because that is a bonkers movie.
I think Zolly Becker loves that movie.
Yeah. Oh, of course he does.
But I only ever watched one episode. Like, it was on Netflix, so the boys were watching it, and Nicole Eggert was the guest host on the first, or the guest star. On the first episode, I'm like, oh, I'm going to watch this. So I'll watch this with you boys. Just want to see what this Super Mario show is like. But, oh, she looks stinking hot in that show. Well, boy, I tell you what, I was talking to my friend Rob last night. I said, what a goddamn fall from grace that woman was. She's turned into a complete feminazi now. It's just like, ugh.
She thinks that's how to salvage her career.
Ugh. Well, yeah, you'll notice a lot of people have kind of started doing that on Twitter because they notice that you get lots of likes and approval from the echo chamber there.
Yeah.
So.
Oh yeah, Twitter. I've heard about that place. I haven't been there for quite a while. Yeah. Like Facebook. Right, yeah. Still. Yeah. Just. Yeah. Haven't really missed Facebook at all since I've ditched it. Gab's fun though. I'm enjoying that place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Indeed. So, the movie we're doing today is the masterpiece gangster movie, probably tilting my hand a little too much, but The Long Good Friday, starring Bob Hoskins and Helen Mirren. And the movie is kind of a very, very bad day in the life of a London gangster named Harold Shand, played by Hoskins. And he's about to do a deal with the mafia, the American mafia, with a guy played by Eddie Constantine, the great Eddie Constantine, let me caution himself. But as this deal is entering its final stages, people in Harold's circle show up dead, and places that he owns are starting to get bombed, and it puts the deal in very serious jeopardy. And so what you're seeing is like a gangster who's sort of this, you know, king of the city. He's his character's sort of like an emperor,
yeah,
who at the beginning of the day seems as though his empire is the greatest it's ever been, and he doesn't know it yet, but you know, the barbarians are about to burn the place to the ground, and he has no clue. But the fun of this movie is kind of trying to figure out what's going on, why this is happening to him, and you know, just the sort of greater existential crisis it goes through. But the name is sort of a great allegory, because it is sort of a passion play for this gangster. It's sort of his it's sort of his crucifixion, and his crucifixion of others. He feels more like a Roman emperor than a Christ figure. But I first saw this movie not too long ago, and it was on Filmstruck until recently. But Stu, you picked this one. Why'd you pick it?
Well, I'd seen it, I think, back about 2002. I think it was the first time I ever saw this one. I was recommended it by a guy I knew back then, and he just kept raving on about The Long Good Friday, and I got my hands on it. I found it somewhere and watched it, and I was really taken aback just how good it was. Especially the performance by Bob Hoskins just blew me away how good he was.
Yeah.
Because I'd seen stuff like, you know, Who Framed Roger Rabbit. No, I liked him in that, but, you know, it's...
Yeah, that's where my generation knows him best from, yeah. Probably.
Yeah,
that's
right.
And Mario Brothers.
God. But I was taken aback at just how good he was, and I really enjoyed the film, and I'd only seen it, I think, about twice. It would have been back in 01-02 when I first saw it. I can't remember the exact year. And not long after that, I think I would have seen it pretty close together. But I've been at least 15 to 16 years removed from it. So I came across it on the shelf. I thought, geez, Long Good Friday. Yeah, wouldn't mind seeing that again. But my DVD copy wasn't great, so I tracked down a HD version of it and wanted to see it in a much clearer picture. So I got my hands on a HD version of it and wanted to see it that way. So I think the DVD version I had was like a full frame effort, you know, one of those backyard companies, and yeah, I wanted to see it with a bit more clearer vision of it, with a bit more you know, fresher eyes, and just thought it'd be an interesting piece to talk about.
You're so right, though, dude. When I first saw it, it was the Thorny-on-My home video that I think HBO had a video company, and it was like the worst transfer. It was full frame, washed out.
Yeah,
it was like it was taken off of a PAL tape.
Yeah, was that was the one we had. Yeah, from a backyarder. Yeah,
the version I have is the old Criterion DVD, which isn't much better. But you know, it, and that's the one I watched again this time. But I was hoping to see it in HD, and I looked for it streaming, but it was only on Filmstruck, and Filmstruck just closed forever. So, oops. So I, you know, went ahead and watched that copy again. But it has the full picture. It's just, it's one of those old Criterion jobs where it's, you know, it needs, badly needs you know, a Blu-ray upgrade. But, you know, I don't know. Is it on Blu-ray in the States? I'm not sure.
I don't know.
I know it is in the UK. It's got a big special edition of it there in the UK. So there's that option.
Yeah, there is a Blu-ray version of it here. It's on Amazon. So
there you go.
I watched an HD version, and I was blown away how good it looked, because I just remember that murky videotape, and dreading, oh no, it won't look like that again, will it?
And oh, and there's like, an Arrow version too in the UK.
Yeah. There you go. Guess who's hitting that proceed to checkout button after the show?
Arrow, the Arrow shelf getting a little lonely. Wants another edition.
Oh, speaking of that, just real quickly on the side there, when I was at the tea with the dinner I should have with my friends last night, Rob quietly mentioned to me, we were talking about Amazon. He goes, oh, I heard Amazon's coming back to Australia. Like, you can order from Amazon US again. They're going to ship to Australia. I said, no, I haven't heard nothing about it. And sure enough, went home and looked up, and they quietly reversed their decision about no more shipping to Australia from the US during the Black Friday, or just before the Black Friday sale. So, yeah, there's that option up again. But not the UK, which is where I predominantly was ordering from towards the end there. So hopefully they'll do the same thing with the UK and sort that shit out. But the US version's option, I mean, it's 10% dearer now because they're putting 10% tax on for the fucking state or the federal government. But whatever, at least I've still got that option if I need to. So let's hope they do it with the UK one.
Yeah. But yeah, so there's some options there to see it. You can do a double feature with Mona Lisa or something, Neil Jordan. But anyway... But Long Good Friday is directed by a guy named John McKenzie, who I've never seen or heard of his other movies.
Because they all got dumped, except for the fourth Protocol, almost just went straight to video.
Yeah, I mean, he died not a few years back in 2011, but yeah, the last movie he did, well, there's one called Avenger. But yeah, it's like some TV stuff, some... you know, some direct-to-video over here stuff like Quicksand with Michael Keaton and Michael Caine. But
Paul McCartney videos. And I remember Last of the Finest getting a big release on videotape with Brian Dennehy, but it never played theaters.
You know what? That one just got a Blu-ray release from Kino Lorber.
That's because they got that deal with you know, they've actually got the licenses on all these old movies that were produced by independents in the 80s. You know, like by Live or IVE, Trans World Entertainment, all of them. So they're just Hemdale, you know, all these companies that are long gone.
Yeah, exactly. And this movie was produced by Handmade Films. Mm-hmm. And I remember for a while Criterion was releasing all of their stuff and then it all went out of print. But some of it's come back. Like, you know, they produced Time Bandits,
Life of Brian,
How to Get Ahead in Advertising.
Well, it was George Harrison's cover. They actually just picked it up
because
it couldn't get released. They had made it, and they were going to try to air it on television, and they wanted to air a censored version. They prepped a version with Bob Hoskins' voice dubbed by another actor for the American market, and the director was pissed off, so was Hoskins. And Handmade Films ended up picking up the movie and giving it a regular release, and it didn't play the U.S. until, like, 1982.
Oh.
Because Handmade was big about getting that stuff into the cities over here through whatever distributor they were working with. But, it took a couple of years before they saw it in the U.S., where the critics went nuts for it. I remember they raved about this movie when it was released back in 82.
Yeah, it's got a pretty solid reputation. It's the BFI's top 100 British films list. It's number 21. Not a bad claim achievement.
Yeah, it's a fair achievement, for sure.
Yeah. And Empire Magazine, you know, says it's number 19 on their 100 best British films list. but it's easy to see why. I mean, I've been rewatching a lot of gangster movies lately, so it's kind of perfect to do this. And, you know, I think this is one of the better gangster flicks out there. And it's certainly one of the better British gangster movies I've seen. You know, if your only familiarity with British gangster movies is the Guy Ritchie stuff, you know, check this out because it'll
He used two actors from this who were in bit parts.
Oh yeah,
and which ones?
I think it was the guy who played the councilman was the mob boss in Snatch, I think.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, or one of those actors, and then another one was I think the main mob boss in Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels. But it wasn't like significant. It was guys who were in this movie for like 20 minutes and were pretty memorable.
Well, because Pierce Brosnan is in this movie in two scenes for like a few seconds,
mm-hmm.
As an IRA guy, I like to think of The Foreigner with Jackie Chan as the unofficial sequel to this.
I didn't even think of that. I should have connected that.
That's Pierce Brosnan's character as a young man from The Foreigner. When I watched The Foreigner, I did not expect it to be a movie about the IRA.
Oh.
And the troubles and bringing back the troubles. And
I think that's why it was so hard to market over here.
It was like
a Jackie Chan movie, which is deceptive.
It's really not. It's a movie about Pierce. It's kind of like The Long Good Friday a little bit with Pierce Brosnan as this former IRA guy turned politician who's trying to keep a lid on everything.
Right. Jackie Chan is the IRA.
Pretty much. Yeah. He's the guy who's going to screw it all up for him. But, but Pierce Brosnan, at the beginning, one of Harold's kind of business mate, one of his top guys is this gangster who sort of has a taste for men. He's gay. And Pierce Brosnan is the honeypot at the swimming pool that lures him into the shower and kills him. In a pretty small but significant part in the film.
Mm.
Very, very young Pierce Brosnan. I don't know if he was Remington Steele at this point or not.
No, I don't think he was.
A couple of years before.
A couple of years before, yeah. Because I think it was made in 79, released 80.
It feels like the 70s in it. I mean, even though, if it's 1980, it's still 70s fashion.
Yeah.
Also had problems because the IRA was the topic. And that it's one of the reasons it had trouble getting released. It couldn't be released in 79. It was very controversial.
Well, it's like when The Godfather was made, there were problems with the mafia.
Yeah.
And the guy who played Luca Brasi in the movie was an actual gangster. We met with Coppola at the, I think Frank Sinatra arranged a meeting. And Coppola liked the way he looked. And I heard that he would read his lines nervously on the set. that's why they wrote that scene, because they thought it was hilarious that he would sit there and say his lines over and over again. He was an arsonist, and he would fill a house up, he would burn stuff down for the insurance money, and he would tie a tampon to a mouse's tail and set it on fire and have it run through the house and burn the place down.
Wow, that's more imaginative than anything Mario Puzo actually came up with in his novel.
He would also put a candle on a cuckoo clock and leave and
this was a controversial production because of the IRA problems at the time.
Well, this was when that was going on. I mean, it's not like The Foreigner where that's well after the fact.
It was like making a movie about ISIS or, Al Qaeda, right after 9/11.
In Syria.
Yeah, in Syria. With Mike Cernovich in a bit part,
Yeah. I predicted this.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, the thing at the center of the movie, though, we were talking about Bob Hoskins. I mean, Bob Hoskins, the moment you see him, he looks like a gorilla in a suit.
He does. He looks like he's packing a rug on top as well a bit.
Yeah, he looks like, an ape. Like the moment you see him, he looks like an ape who is barely civilized. And, he kind of reminds me a little bit of Santino Corleone in The Godfather if he was able to control himself a little more. Yeah. Because he looks like he's about to explode at any given point.
Right.
The way he grits his teeth. And he always looks like he just looks like he's about to go off. But he doesn't. During the final act, you see what happens when he goes full ape on people. And it has some incredibly disturbing violence in there.
Oh yeah.
You can see why this movie got an X rating.
Yeah, even by today's standards, it's pretty bloody.
Yeah, yeah. When they get that drug pusher in his room, and they start cutting his butt and stuff like that with the machete.
Yeah.
This used to be a nice neighborhood.
Yeah, you know what he's implying there.
My smart face.
Yeah.
There's a lot of pretty overt racism in the movie, and especially towards the Irish.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's a very anti-Irish movie.
Yeah, and when they meet with the Irish, the Irish gangsters, you know, they're doing the stock car racing thing. It's like redneck stuff.
Oh, yeah. I was expecting them to... Didn't he call them rednecks?
Yeah.
He did.
Like, I didn't know that was an expression for Irish, like in the UK, or maybe around this time.
I'm guessing because there was Americans in the film, they were trying to market it towards America and use an American term, I guess.
Possibly, yeah.
Sort of, you know, give us a point of reference to how they think of them.
Right.
Trying to paint them out as rednecks so people in the, you know, like in America would go, oh, the Irish must be rednecks as well.
They're just like us, fellas.
Or if somebody knows better, and the Irish have always been referred to as rednecks, I'd like to know.
Mm.
Yeah, I would.
Yeah, and maybe that's been a distorted use of the term that we maybe referred to Irishmen, because aren't most hillbillies and rednecks supposed to be descended from Irish?
Well, you know, yeah, a lot of the sort of you know, cheap labor that was brought down here against their will were Irishmen. Out in the fields, and a lot of them like burned real bad, and I don't know if that's where they got the term rednecks from.
Because I always heard, oh, it was a farmer who worked out in the sun all day, and his neck was burned. I don't know. That seems, it could be a slur from England for the Irish.
Yeah, well, you have to, you know, too, like in the South, you know, it was a very English style society. like a lot of the sort of accents and stuff from the American South come, you know, are kind of mutations of stuff from England.
Right.
You reckon?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Well,
you guys are no better than me.
But no, yeah. When you look at the Old South, it's a very old English style society with, you know, big plantations and
stuff. Oh, like the antebellum sort of.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's what I'm talking about. Oh,
okay. It's aristocratic or whatever, but it's like, but you don't see that in the Northeast. You don't see much English influence. You might see like a London influence in terms of like a huge slummy part of the city. But
you see an Irish influence in Boston. You should know that, John.
Yeah. You do see that in Boston. It's like,
yeah.
Boston's an exception. That's like, it's a joke how Irish that city is.
Is it Boston or South Boston? It's predominantly the Irish.
It's Southy, South Boston.
That's right. The Irish. Yeah.
Irish ghetto of sorts or whatever.
Mm. Yeah. Nice area, though, that I went through. Looked okay to me. Didn't seem like the slums. Yeah. It didn't seem like a slum anyway.
Right.
What's that place in Boston that shithole? Oh, fuck, I forgot the name. There was a documentary about a bunch of crackheads who lived there. One of them was the ex-boxer.
Dorchester or Roxbury?
No, it wasn't Dorchester. That's where the Wahlbergs are from.
Wasn't it Roxbury?
No, it's like one word. It's not a word broken up into...
Oh, like a one-syllable thing?
Yeah, one syllable. Yeah. I'll have to look it up. I'll let you know. I'm sure you'll know of it once you hear it.
Oh, yeah. That place. Yeah.
Yes, that one.
Yeah. But yeah, the brother that Christian Bale played in The Fighter, that documentary about crack.
Right.
Crack in America.
Yeah, the Ward brother. Yeah.
Yeah, Mickey Ward, that's it, yeah. Oh, wow.
But you know, and there is sort of this theme of this veneer of civilization around like a savage, you know, gangster life that like, 'cause the whole thing is his business becoming legitimate, and he kind of reverts back to the sort of native gangster, the violence. To try as in an attempt to save his legitimate civilized business, which is very vague, but he refers to his business as the corporation. You know?
Oh, John, right. It's Lowell. L-O-W.
Lowell. Oh, weird. Lowell.
That's it. Yeah.
I don't think I ever went there or anything. I don't think I was ever there. Never went through it. So it doesn't. I never heard much about it when I lived there. But maybe there's a reason nobody wanted to talk about it.
Yeah. Dickie Edlund. Yeah, that's the one, yeah. There's a documentary, High on Crack Street. That was trying to think of Lost Lives in Lowell.
Okay.
Yeah. Depressing as
high on High on Crack Street.
Yeah, that's the name of it, yeah.
Well, that's the original name of New Jack City, by the way.
Boston is very connected to Ireland because almost everybody you would you'd always talk to a coworker that, oh, I just spent my month in Ireland this year or something. You know, they apparently flights to Ireland were pretty cheap, so they would.
Yeah, it's like being a Jewish and going to Israel. You know.
Yeah, it is. It's but, like, yeah, I was just in Ireland for 6 months. And, you know, like I'd do temp jobs and I'd work with Irish people, and they were like, oh yeah, we got to get the experience. There's no experience in Ireland. You know, it's just like, geez, I feel like, and I thought it was a put on because. The actual Irish accent when you encounter it is just as cartoonish as you hear on TV.
Oh, yeah. No,
just like Russians. When Russians are speaking broken English, it's exactly like Yakov Smirnoff. Yeah. So you can almost think the guy's pulling your leg when he's doing it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I will say
one thing. It's frightening how close in looks and structure and or infrastructure and stuff Boston is to Melbourne. It is scary. It's,
you know who said that was Sammo Hung's wife, who was from Melbourne. Joyce Godinzi, whatever you want to call her. She's in Eastern Condors, but she said the same thing. She's from Melbourne, and she was like, Boston is exactly like Melbourne.
She's really from Melbourne. I know they filmed over here for
Mr. Nice Guy,
that was it. Yeah,
she has a cameo in the beginning. She catches food when Jackie's throwing it to the audience.
Watching that, I think I repeated it before in the show, but I'll say it again. Watching Mr. Nice Guy in the theater with Rob, and we're going, this is fucking stupid. Apart from the fact the film is dumb, it's like he's running down Lonsdale Street. They're still running, but now they're on fucking Flinders Street. Two different directions. It's
well,
like,
that's the curse whenever you're from a city.
And you'd see that
you
Hunter
watch
with,
a movie shot there. Like, yeah. I'm sure if you're from San Francisco and you watch Bullet, you're going to be screaming at the screen.
Oh,
I've heard that.
People who live in L.A. laugh about the finale of Lethal Weapon where Mel Gibson catches up with a car on foot. And they said, no, he's like catching up with it 10 miles over on this other highway pass, overpass or whatever. They said it's pretty laughable. And whenever I watch a movie in New Orleans, they always use the same New Orleans locations and Boston. It's always a very open space that they'll have secret confidential meetings in. And it's a place by a public park that I know in Boston.
Well, there's that movie that we never did the episode on that I worked on, Losers Take All. That I did locations for, and there's a scene where they go on tour and they're leaving Memphis, and you know, you have like the little montage where they're traveling, and then they get to the next town, and it's just another part where you drive into Memphis.
They're in Germantown.
No, they're like, it's literally like two highways that go into the same part of town.
Right.
That are not that far apart.
Yeah. That's one of the tropes of watching a film in your own city. You think, oh, great, it's good to see your own city in the big screen. You think, oh, it's just all over the place.
Oh, it takes you out of the movie.
It really does. It really does.
I mean, because nobody who's not from Melbourne is going to have those problems watching Mr. Nice Guy. Nobody will notice. They'll be caught up in the action. But when you know those areas, you go, wait a second, that doesn't work.
No.
Yeah.
No. But I'm sure it's the same with British films. They probably film in one part of, you know, East London, and they're meant to be in one spot, and they're somewhere else altogether. So, yeah, that is a problem that people will have who do know the area as well as they do. But, you know, that's why I say suspension of disbelief, but it's a little hard when you are caught up going, wrong area, wrong area, wrong area, wrong area.
Oh, like when I watch Tightrope and Eastwood and Geneviève Bujold, they're basically circling the French Quarter.
Oh, really?
In a car chase. Yeah, they're like, he's just driving around the French Quarter over and over again on the same road.
One thing about this movie that I really like, and John, I know you'll be able to speak to this. I remember when I watched this movie, I watched this and several other films that just happened to have Eddie Constantine in them.
Oh.
I watched this. I watched Lars von Trier's Europa. And something else, and Eddie Constantine just kept showing up in these movies I was watching. But Eddie Constantine is really cool.
Yeah, he is. Really cool.
You know, for those of you who don't know, he played a detective named Lemmy Caution. And the most famous of those movies, and probably the weirdest one, is Jean-Luc Godard's Alphaville.
Yeah,
which kind of ruined the series for commercially. Am I wrong? You know more about this than I do.
Well, it's totally done away from the style of the French Lemmy Caution movies he made in the 50s, throughout the 50s, and they're believed to have possibly inspired Ian Fleming when he was writing the James Bond novels is like in one he's tied to the back of a speedboat and he's treated as shark bait. You know, it's a he was a detective who got into all sorts of dealing with like incredible villains, and it has all the kind of film noir stuff with the nightclub singers and everything, and they're really cool flicks, and he's great in them, and he dubbed his own voice for the English dubs, and they're considered classics in France. They were in America, they were kind of only known as like late night TV things. And I don't think they were ever released theatrically in any big way. But Alphaville's sort of like an artsy take on it or tribute to those movies. And
yeah, it was sort of
not,
like...
It's not... I wouldn't judge the series by watching Alphaville, even though I think Alphaville's okay. But I think the actual, Lemmy Caution movies are great. And I think one of them is on Amazon Prime right now, French with English subtitles.
Oh, that would be that. Just, I'd have to check that out.
Just look up Eddie Constantine on Amazon Prime, and it should come right up.
Yeah, because I mean, you know, Alphaville has that kind of art house cred because it's got the Jean-Luc Godard connection, but it is a weird movie. You know,
yeah.
Whenever it's a very odd science fiction noir. It's basically just Jean-Luc Godard's, you know, bizarre take on it.
I recommend that to hardcore film buffs. I recommend the regular. You know, Lemmy Caution movies to just regular movie viewers
exactly.
Who would like to see a good thriller from the 50s and see what they were like in France.
He was
an Edith Piaf. I think he was mentored by Edith Piaf of all people. She convinced him to stay in France. He was an American. He was over there as a singer, and he stayed in France and became a movie star.
Well, he's got that really cool gravelly voice. He's got that rock hard face.
Yeah.
You know, you see him in this movie and you're like, ho, 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 who's this guy? You know, he's pretty cool. You know, like, what
yeah.
else? Don't mess with us, you know.
Right. Yeah. It was cool to see him actually play a role in Sync Sound and no dubbing or whatever. And, you know, hear his real voice and everything while he's acting. It was really neat. But he did. I'm just looking at his list and he did a lot of movies in France. Something I don't think I've been seen over here. He even played Nick Carter, the American pulp detective in a movie called License to Kill in 64. That's pretty good. So, he's an interesting actor who completely unknown in America.
Yeah, you know, he did a lot of kind of art house stuff, but you look at him and you just go, oh, this guy needed, like, you know, he's like a Mike Hammer. He looks like a Mickey Spillane creation or something.
He would have been a great Mike Hammer if they had cast him in those.
But yeah, one that I liked, I thought, you know, one that I saw him pop up in was Europa, which is a really weird post-World War II German thriller.
Hmm.
Pretty interesting movie that I watched, like, right around this one.
Yeah, he's memorable in this as the mobster from America, and also the other mafia guy. I can look up that actor who played Tony.
Mm-hmm.
That actor, Stephen Davies, who mainly just does kind of regular work in Hollywood. But here's the funny thing. He appeared in a supporting role along with Bob Hoskins in a comedy film made in 1975 in Hollywood starring Richard Dreyfuss called Inserts. So
interesting.
It must have been Bob Hoskins' friendship with him. They got him a role in The Long Good Friday when they were making it in, you know, 1978 or whenever.
He was also in Revenge of the Nerds 4, Nerds in Love.
Good my God.
Well, he has stayed busy.
There's a fall from grace right there.
No one recovers from that sort of thing.
But he played a lot of different roles in different Star Trek shows, too, like DS9 and Voyager.
That's good regular work if you're an actor in Hollywood. That's
I'll tell you one film.
Residuals and everything.
I'll tell you one film that this reminded me of. Watching it again was, have you guys ever seen Get Carter with Michael Caine?
Yeah.
Remind me a lot about that.
Yeah, that's another great British gangster movie.
Mm.
Yeah, and so is the one with Sylvester Stallone. Just
no,
kidding. Oh
no,
my gosh.
Yeah, oh, I'm glad you got that just kidding in quick enough.
You had to throw that in there.
That was a dangerous joke to make because that's one that could get you killed. You know?
Yeah, our pal Eric Zaldivar is like an expert on Get Carter. He's got collected all the stories about that character that the original novelist wrote, like the rare short stories and everything. He's got all sorts of rare shit on that movie.
Yeah. I remember I was on a Stallone kick and I watched the remake of Get Carter and I was I was like, how bad can it be? Oh boy.
Oh God.
Oh my God.
Oh, that's bad.
Didn't want to cover it on Slycast.
Yeah.
That film's bad, but I tell you what, watching Driven with Stallone was even worse.
I've never seen
it. It was an editing nightmare.
Oh, Stallone has made worse movies than Get Carter, but Get Carter is particularly bad considering it's a remake of a well-liked movie.
Like Avenging
I'm
Angelo.
Harsh on Stallone's work, man. I am. I don't even like Cliffhanger.
I don't think I've ever seen Cliffhanger. My brother raves on and on about Cliffhanger, but I've never seen it.
Cliffhanger's one of those ones that is liked by a lot of people in my generation because they saw it on cable TV a lot.
Right. Okay. One of them. No worries. Anyway, let's get back to the Long Good Friday because we've really strayed from it.
I
tell you, I was impressed with Bob Hoskins, like I said, but I was just as impressed with Helen Mirren.
Yeah, she's fantastic.
Yeah,
it's her best role that I've seen her in.
You know, she's very...
I don't know.
I don't know if it's... I'd have to look at her CV, but it is a great role because she's so cool and collected, and the way she spars with Hoskins during tense scenes, like when she tells him that she told the mafia guys what was going on, because he was kind of like, tell him it was a gas leak or something when the bomb goes. You know, she's kind of tasked by Hoskins' character with sort of stonewalling.
Yeah.
And they sort of say, we know something's going on. Yeah. You might as well tell us. And later she tells Hoskins, I told them what was going on. And he's like, you what? And the way she deals with him is so good.
You know? Yeah, I love that scene. I love that scene where she tells him and he's so pissed.
Yeah.
I would probably argue that her best performance is not this one. As good as it is, I would say in Oh Lucky Man, that was probably my favorite.
Oh, yeah.
I've never seen it.
That's Stu's favorite.
Oh, God. That's got to be a, yeah.
But we might have to do that one because it's my favorite film. I've never seen If or any of that Lindsay Anderson stuff, so.
Yeah. Yeah, that's going on the list. That really is going on the spreadsheet.
We're going to become the Midnight Movies 70s British Movie podcast.
Oh Lucky Man's like the second or third in a series, isn't it?
Second, yeah.
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 But the thing is, though, is that she's not like some Mary Sue character where she's just the strong woman, because there's a scene where she breaks down and tells him how scared she is. And it is because the whole premise of this movie is so terrifying because people are dying. Stuff is blowing up left and right. And you don't know what the heck is going on.
No, you don't.
Yeah, the first hour, you don't have a clue. And then you start to get clues.
It's like there are no clues. You do not know what is going on. And there are little things that happen. You notice that there's Irish people running around. And the little bit at the beginning with the woman spitting on the guy.
Yeah.
Kind of gives you a little bit. That's like your only – those are the only real leads you have.
Yeah.
But – But
I'll tell you what. Sorry, just one part that really made me laugh was when they go to that black geezer's house. You know, that Errol, where his name is, that drug dealer, the one that cut up his ass with the machete, and they find him in bed with that girl, and they drag him out of bed. And Bob Hoskins sees the heroin needle and says, "Here, get another prick into you." there's a few one liners in this film. Like Bob Hoskins, just he made me laugh in this one, even though it's not a comedy. It's just those one liners.
But he's got that British humor, though, that kind of dry
sort
of cutting.
Yeah.
Like, whenever he's talking to one of it, like the scene where he kind of figures out the connection to what's going on.
Yeah.
And he's talking to the guy. And it, just the way he alludes to things is so funny.
Yeah.
You know, he has this way of sort of having fun with other people.
But there's one thing mentioned earlier where you said, you said that anytime you watch Bob Hoskins, you can just see he can explode at any second.
Yeah.
And I guess for an actor, I'm not an actor, but for any actor to do that, that's not easy.
No, and I was thinking about like his reactions. There's some parts where he laughs at jokes and stuff like that. I was thinking that is something I would take for granted at watching a movie, but the way he reacts to something like a bad joke from Helen Mirren's character is, I was like, that must be so hard to do take after take.
You know? Well, I would argue the meat locker sequence in its entirety is probably his best 10 minutes on film.
Oh, that's in the abattoir.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was terrific.
Oh yeah, definitely. And just all those guys.
We're not leaving here till we get some verbals.
That's great.
I'll tell you one thing I need to bring up as well. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention it. Was the score? That was like a classic gangster score, and it just, I don't know if there's ever been a soundtrack to this film, because the music is minimal and it's not peppered with songs like, you know, Toy
Wilcox. It's not like a Scorsese film.
Guy Ritchie, where he's got like 60s garage rock played throughout. And,
yeah, well, different time. It's like 20 years later.
It's almost like a John Carpenter soundtrack a little bit.
Apparently it was overused in the film to cover up John McKenzie shouting instructions to Bob Hoskins. On the set. No, seriously, that was one of the trivia points on IMDb and Wikipedia, is that the soundtrack was made super loud so they wouldn't have to work around that too much.
No, if you're going to do it, at least have a good soundtrack, and this one definitely does.
Yeah.
But it's great. Got that main theme when it plays at the very end. That final shot of the movie is one of my favorite final shots in a movie ever. Because I really like endings that don't end definitively. They keep going in your head when the movie's over.
Open-ended endings, yeah.
Yeah, it's open-ended where the movie kind of keeps going.
A sequel was written, but never filmed, where he did survive that whole incident, like the car crashed and he was the only one alive or something. And he came back to London like 20 years later because I guess Jamaican gangsters were taking over the scene.
Yeah, then it starts becoming a Steven Seagal movie. This was before
Marked for Death. This was like written apparently in 1982 by the original screenwriter. So who knows?
Yeah, I don't think I would have. I mean, I would have wanted to have seen it, but leave it as it is. It's too good as it is.
Right. No, it's a classic as it is, and you know, it wasn't regarded as a classic until like maybe 10 years after its release, and then suddenly it was like, oh, this is a gangster classic.
Yeah, it's one of those films that I would say, you know, the ending being open-ended is one thing that makes it so good, because that last shot, it just holds on Hoskins' face for a long time.
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
He's gritting his teeth, looking around, thinking about everything that's happened in the film. You really, it's your life flashing before your eyes. It's so good.
And thank goodness they don't pepper it with. Thank goodness they don't pepper it with flashbacks as well. We didn't need that.
Because you, the audience, are thinking about everything that's happened, everything that's gone wrong. You know, oh, in that scene, you know what? Maybe he shouldn't have killed those people. You know, but one thing I love too is that he is sort of the elite. He's sort of the Roman emperor who doesn't understand what he's up against. You know, everybody tries to tell him, look, these people are fanatics. You know, you can't kill them. And he just is like, nope, yes, I can. I can deal with this just like I've dealt with everything else. You know?
Yeah, it's an old story that I actually love and I don't see in movies enough, is when like a very strong crime organization has to deal with an outside attack from another criminal organization, they don't know how to deal with it.
And they don't understand it because they don't work on the same level they do. Because with the IRA, it's not business. I mean, right, it's about something more.
I just love it. That was the interesting parts in Marked for Death, was the idea of Jamaican posses were attacking mobsters and they didn't know how to deal with it. And I thought that was fascinating. And very few movies deal with that topic. I think it's an exciting story potential.
I'd say one
Long
film.
Good Friday's one of the ones.
Yeah, not In the Name of the Father. I fucking hate that movie. That is such a pro-Irish movie. It's just a load of shit.
Yeah, that didn't work at all.
One thing about, you know, they make, you know, Eddie Constantine goes, this has been like a day in Vietnam. But it is kind of like a Vietnam movie or something, where we're dealing with an enemy that he does not understand, but he thinks he understands it, and he deals with it in an incredibly stupid way. And it's his downfall. And so that's sort of that is an interesting concept, John, because it's something that, you know, you can take that geopolitical idea and boil it down to the gangster film. You know,
I just love that when you have these different things having to battle, they're battling each other, and it's completely out of left field. Like, you don't even know what the hell is going on half the time. I love that idea. And you don't see it in movies enough because everybody goes the predictable route, trying to make a Charles Bronson movie, or nowadays just a Fast and Furious type thing. But I think it's a great concept that's never been exploited fully. You know, why rip off Die Hard when you can rip this movie off and make some exciting action thrillers? You know?
Yeah, exactly.
I got stuck in real life at an IRA fake bomb blast in London. We were over in London in 88, and we got evacuated out of the place we were eating in the restaurant. It was like lunchtime, and there was because the IRA, if you know anything about them, would plant a bomb, but then call to give notice where it is. So they create chaos in the area while they defuse the bomb.
So, yeah, it was more about spreading fear.
Than more so than
they did kill people.
Oh, they killed people. I have no fucking love for the IRA. I kind of get their cause, but I don't get their tactics and their methods to it.
Well, it's one of those things where, you know, there's a radical political cause that you're like, I totally sympathize with these people.
Yeah.
But then they start murdering innocents. And then you go, or people who have nothing to do with that problem that they're addressing.
Yeah.
And that's when it becomes you're like, okay, well, you're just alienating people now. You know, people aren't going to support you because you're killing civilians, you know?
That's right. And, when I was in London in 88, back in that May or June, I think it was May, it was the same time that I was reading the NME magazine, the New Musical Express, the free local music paper, and it was the same time that Megadeth was there and Mustaine did his Give Ireland Back to the Irish, because the music journo in there writing about it was writing about Megadeth live. They were playing there, but all he wrote about was Mustaine's big mouth, you know, Give Ireland Back to the Irish. I thought, oh, you idiot.
So what he did was he was about to play a song, and he goes, this one's for the cause!
Yeah.
Oh,
God. And it caused a big stir, and Mustaine said, well, before the show, people were propagandizing me on it, and I thought it sounded great, and I thought I really sympathized with them. But then I spouted out on stage, and then I found out there was this whole other angle to it, and I went, "Oh crap!" So he wrote the song "Holy Wars," which he wrote. That was the inspiration for one of Megadeth's best songs, you know. So that incident led to some good tracks on Rust in
Peace.
And
I actually think I still have that particular edition of the magazine. I brought it back with me from London and put it in the big box that I keep with all my other collectibles from over the years. I think I've still got it. I remember distinctly Queensryche on the front cover of the NME of that week. So I'll have to check it out and see if I've got it.
Yeah, that would be cool to check it. If you have that would be cool to like scan in and post or something.
Yeah, I'd like to do that. But like I guess I've got to find it. I'm pretty sure I've got it. I don't think I would have tossed it. So it's just a case of finding the bastard.
Yeah. Like a needle in a haystack.
More like a heroin needle in a haystack. It's a bit bigger to find.
It's a bit bigger than...
Yeah. Anybody else got any other thoughts on this one?
Other than how many times Beat Takashi Kitano has ripped this film off for his overrated Yakuza thrillers.
Oh my gosh, I hadn't thought about that, but you're right.
He's ripped these off endlessly. He always plays a badass Yakuza who's in over his head and ends up dead by the end of the movie.
Yeah, no, that's always the plot, is that Beat Takeshi is the coolest dude with a twitch nerve disorder in the room.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, forces close in on him and he goes out in a blaze of glory.
He's been ripping this film off, and it was obvious when I watched it last night. I went, shit, it's a Beat Takeshi movie. He's been ripping these things off, or ripping this film off constantly. And everybody praises him for it because they haven't seen this.
Or they don't associate it with it.
Yeah, like, they didn't catch it. I caught it right away. I was like, oh, shit.
Japanese movies, you know, when you watch them as a Westerner, and you know, you tend to ghettoize them in your mind a little bit.
You think they're original and it's all Far East-based. No.
Well,
they're just as derivative of American and British cinema as anything.
Oh, it's, no, yeah. Like, the Kenji Fukasaku films are totally, you know, we watched American crime movies, you know, that were from, you know, kind of taking those sort of that aesthetic, the Friedkin aesthetic almost.
Yeah, well, it's like the samurai films are very inspired by John Ford and Howard Hawks, and you would never know that reading critics raving over those things. It's I love them too, but I know that they're inspired by American
Westerns.
Well,
what was it? Our boy Joe Carducci in the Stone Mail, he took them to task for this. He said that Donald Ritchie, who's the guy for like Kurosawa films and stuff like that.
Yeah.
He said he always kind of tended to ignore the American side of things because he said he thought it would kind of he wanted to seem more specialized or something.
Right.
I can't remember exactly how he put it, so forgive me, Joe, if I'm screwing up what you said. But it's sort of he wanted it to be this thing on its own or something. But yeah, it's one of those things where he seemed to imply that Ritchie probably knew this but chose not to say it in order to sort of kind of have a guru monopoly on
it. Right, and Akira Kurosawa is always crediting Dashiell Hammett and John Ford in his interviews and everything.
Yeah.
And he was actually considered too westernized by Japanese.
Yeah, I mean, Kurosawa has only recently become considered to be a great filmmaker in the Japanese consciousness because his movies were so Western, whereas if you were to ask the Japanese critics who were their great filmmakers were, they were more likely to say Mizoguchi or Ozu.
Yep.
They weren't likely to they would have probably thought of Kurosawa as being on the same level as Ishiro Honda. Maybe. Well, that might be an exaggeration, but still, you know, that Kurosawa was considered to be, you know, because he did adaptations of Western stuff like Hammett, Chekhov. Who am
Red Harvest is Yojimbo.
Yeah, Red Harvest is Yojimbo, but I'm thinking of, The Lower Depths.
Right.
Thinking of the stuff like, well, he did
High and Low. He does an Ed McBain novel.
Yeah. Yeah, he did The Idiot, which is Dostoevsky, I think. He did some Russian stuff. He did Shakespeare with Throne of Blood and The Bad Sleep Well, which is Macbeth.
Yeah, to go back to my point, Takashi Kitano just ripped this movie off over and over again.
Excuse me, I said scored. Just let me correct myself. I said Macbeth. I meant Hamlet.
Right.
Throne of Blood is Macbeth.
Well, I think he did King Lear for Ron.
Yes, Ron was King Lear.
Yeah.
Yeah, all that Shakespeare.
But this is a hugely influential film. It's like it was a big influence internationally. So I think there's probably a lot of foreign films that were inspired by it.
But I would say if you're a gangster movie aficionado, you gotta see this movie. This is I think a key film in the gangster oeuvre.
It's a milestone.
Yeah,
I think it's up there with, you know, The Godfather, Goodfellas, all that good stuff. You know, the Little Caesar, Public Enemy, Scarface, you know.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I agree.
Yeah. So, Stuart, any other thoughts for you?
Not really, no. Just seek it out and give 2 hours of your time to it because you will not be disappointed.
Yeah, absolutely. Seek it out. I think it's a fantastic film. So what would you give it, Stuart?
I'll give it an 8 because I've only seen it once, like I said, in about the last 15 years. I want to go and see it again. I really actually want to go and see it again sort of tomorrow and find more in it. Because as I said earlier on, the print I had was just that crappy full frame thing and didn't do it justice and it was murky and looked like it'd been dragged through the mud. So seeing it again for the first time in HD today, yeah, I really want to watch it again. Because it is a messy first hour. It's always, you know, sort of always throwing me for a loop, like, who's that? And who's that? And who's that guy?
Well, the first, I'll say it's a movie that rewards watch it and then watch it again. Because, like you said, I think the first 30 minutes, the first 20 minutes, it's kind of slow to get going because you're not really sure what's happening.
Yeah.
And the stuff that's happening is important later. And so when you watch it again, you go, oh, okay, that's what I'm looking at. You know, you sort of put it all together. But it's a movie that is that rewards you to watch it a few times.
Yeah, that's correct.
John, what? So did you rate it out of 10, Stu? I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah, 8. Yeah.
He gave it an 8. Oh, John, what would you give it?
Give it 8.5.
8.5. I'm going to give it a 10. I think it's I think it's a quintessential gangster film. Yeah. I initially gave it a 9 when I saw it, but I'm giving it a 10 because I just the performance, Bob Hoskins' performance, it's up there with Pacino and Ray Liotta and Marlon Brando. It is a phenomenal gangster character.
It was mentioned by lots of Hollywood actors mentioned this as his performance is hugely influential. Like they said, if they wanted to watch a great performance, they would watch Long Good Friday and Hoskins.
Yeah, I agree.
It influenced a lot of gangsters that came after, the way Brando, Pacino, Liotta, De Niro, you know, people like this have influenced gangster performance. Edward G. Robinson.
Yeah.
What's his name? What's the guy who played the original Scarface?
Paul Mooney.
Yeah. Paul Mooney, all these people, James Cagney, you know, I think it's up there with, you know, the defining gangster.
Yeah, I would agree. Just not your typical gangster, that's all. Because being British, very different.
I think people have sort of a stereotype in their head of the British gangster movie, and I think like the Guy Ritchie films and stuff owe a lot to this. Guy Ritchie has a lot of
Bronson with Tom Hardy, you know, gargling his dialogue and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that movie where he played the craze is probably also gives people the idea of the British gangster movie.
Legend, yeah, that was a damn good film. Damn good movie. I can recommend that one highly.
The one with Hardy?
Yes.
Because I've only seen the one with the Spandau Ballet guys as the craze.
Oh, the Kemp brothers. Yeah, no, that's a good one, but it... And they're good, but it sort of just, you know, goes through a certain period and just glosses right over towards the end. It's like, okay, you don't really get much. I think if you really want to get your fill of the craze, watch The Craze and then watch Legend, because there's some things in either film that's not in the other.
Yeah, I need to seek out a copy of Legend.
Yeah, Legend's great. And having Tom Hardy as both brothers and playing so differently, that's why I want to watch again for sure. It sits on my shelf.
He's not doing his Bane voice, is he?
Oh, no. It's very, very different Tom Hardy. No mask either.
Because he kind of did his Bane voice in Venom. I don't know if it's intentional or he's just stuck on that voice, but it's funny because he's playing a reporter. Hey, this is Eddie Brock reporting from San Francisco. And I'm just like, oh, God, this totally takes me out of it here.
Yeah, it's funny when he's as Ronnie Cray, when he's in the church and his brother Reggie's getting married, he's walking up and down the aisle screaming at people, fucking sing, you cunts, sing!
Yeah, I've ordered his TV show Taboo from the library, so I'll be checking that out this week because I just found out about it. I didn't even know it existed, which is the problem when you have too many friggin' options on streaming. Good actors today are making TV shows and you don't even know it until you just kind of come across a story somewhere online.
No, most of the good actors are dead. My eyes.
Well, that's true. Yeah. But I mean, Tom Hardy doing a TV show for like FX. I mean, he's done like 2 seasons.
Yeah, he's an exception. I would certainly watch stuff he does.
Right.
For sure. But I need to see Dunkirk again, I think. I really need to sit down and watch that one.
Yeah, I need to watch it again too.
That one really just sort of threw me when I watched it. But I mean, I enjoyed it, but yeah, I need to sit down and watch it.
I just want to watch it again because I thought it was good. Yeah.
Okay, Legend Blu-ray at the library. I will reserve it. There we go. Place sold.
Yeah.
It's easy enough.
Yeah. It's a good watch.
All right, lads.
All right.
I'll tell you what I did watch, though, real quick. I did a Clint Eastwood double feature on what night was it? Thursday night when I was home crook with the Lurgy. I watched Breezy. Of course, he's not in either of these two. He's in Breezy, I watched with William Holden and Kate Lynch, and I really, really enjoyed that film. I gotta say, that's a good damn little film. It was made for only $1 million, and it wasn't a hit when it came out, but yeah, wow, that's what a great little movie. Really, really enjoyed it. And the other one I watched was that 1517 to Paris, because I picked it up earlier this year, about 3-4 months back, and it was part of a deal, like 5 for $50 or something like that. I thought, oh, I've watched Breezy, I watched 1517 to Paris. And I'll tell you what, not a long movie, only about an hour and a half, but the first hour and a bit, you're thinking, what's going on? It's just three guys traveling through Europe and they, you know, their lives and their kids. But by the end, you think, fuck, what a movie. Unreal. Yeah. Honey, have you seen it yet?
No.
Hmm.
I liked it quite a bit. I thought it worked very well.
Oh, you've seen it, John? Okay, I didn't realize.
Yeah, it didn't have the bullshit Hollywood story that they always throw in there to try to... They even did that in American Sniper. They like created a rival sniper among Al-Qaeda or whatever for him or whatever.
And
here they didn't do that. They didn't do that any of that stuff. They just made it look like a casual day of the life, and then they suddenly stopped this terrorist attack.
Yeah, and I didn't realize... I knew the three guys... The three leads in the film were the actual real three guys. I didn't realize that the guy who got shot and his wife who was in there in the train were the real ones as well. I'm like, wow, that's unreal to think that guy have to relive that all over again for the film. It was just I thought they would have been actors for the film, but no, they're the real people as well. So
I think Eastwood was trying something new. You know, in this type of biopic or incident movie or whatever.
Man, that guy is like, what, nearly 88, and he's still turning out shit that filmmakers half his age couldn't even dream of.
Yeah, no, he's you know, his longevity in the business has been very impressive.
Well, there's a wisdom to his work that you're not going to find in other filmmakers. You're not going to find it in Michael Bay's stuff.
No.
God, no. You're not going to find it in 13 hours.
Right. Although I hear that's good, but I have not.
Yeah, I'm sure it's all right, but you know, it's probably a lot of, you know, America, you know.
I do need to
get... Craig Zoller loved it. He reviewed it on Amazon.
Ah. No, I'm, you know, Michael Bay, you know, I do like element, like I do like the military supporting aspect of it, but there's sort of a boomer posty element. Yeah,
there's a shallowness to the way he does it.
Exactly.
It can be annoying.
Exactly.
I do need to get that box set of Clint Eastwood's. It's only available in the UK, I think it is, which has got all these early films like Hang 'Em High, Joe Kidd, Two Mules.
Hang 'Em High. How does the YNT song go? I don't know.
I think it goes Hang 'Em High.
It was Van Halen, wasn't it?
No, that was YNT. Well, there's a Van Halen Hang 'Em High too, probably.
Yeah,
but
there is. The YNT. Yeah.
It's a popular movie.
Okay.
It was very popular on TV, especially around the time those albums were recorded. It was showing somewhere every other weekend. So.
Yeah. So I want to get that box set. It's only like £20 or something. It's fucking cheap for all those movies.
Amazon UK drives me nuts. They have a lot of stuff they will not ship to the US.
Is there?
Yeah, they're getting dicks about that. They used to not care, and now they're getting strict about it. Amazon Germany was real bad about that. You know, this does not ship to your address, and we will not ship this to America.
Wow, there was some things that...
We will not ship this to America.
Yeah, and now Amazon UK has become just as bad. Like, I was looking at Ashes to Ashes because I'm interested in watching it, but it's like, okay, there's the box set. It's been reissued. It's way too overpriced. I'm not going to buy it. But this does not ship to America anyway. So I was like, oh, I'll fuck it.
Jesus. I never, ever had a problem when they were shipping to Australia from Amazon UK. They never, ever... said, not this product, no. Amazon US,
Somebody put a new installment in the contracts or something for licensing.
Why the fuck would they do that? I mean...
I don't know. It's so fucking weird. It's like 88 Films. They were selling movies off their website. Right. And you sell stuff through Amazon UK. Well, now they said, we're not selling the Shaw Brothers movies to Americans off of our website because they made a licensing deal, but you could buy them and have them shipped to America off Amazon UK. So it makes no sense at all.
Oh my goodness.
Because the licensing's all whacked up because nobody understands the American market and the British market. So, you know,
the American market is pretty fucked at times.
Well, it's like they don't understand that those cult movies are not going to sell 80,000 copies in America.
No.
The audience is dying off. It's getting old. They don't buy these things anymore. They don't upgrade to high def unless they're like serious home video fanatics. And, you know, it's just, you're not going to get this type of sales in this country for cult movies. It just, it isn't going to happen. I mean, you should hear some of the stuff I've heard about like Italian horror and even Hammer films. They would take a bath on that stuff.
Oh, speaking of real quick, just speaking of high def, I did get in last week, a few movies from Amazon Australia. I've started using them. Mm-hmm. And I got the Buck Rogers series, season 1 and 2, on Blu-ray. Well, it cost me $25 for the lot. Right. And, oh my God, fucking Gary Coleman's in an episode of Buck Rogers.
Oh, he's like the president of the universe or something, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah, it's some ridiculous fucking... And Jamie Lee Curtis is in one episode just stoned off her tits. So, yeah. I've always said, you really want to see Jamie Lee Curtis stoned in a movie, watch Blue Steel. She is off her face throughout that whole thing.
Oh, God.
Yeah, that...
I saw that at a theater. Ooh. The insane Ron Silver.
Yeah.
Terror of the world.
Fucking ridiculous. All right, boys.
All right, guys.
Let's pack it up. Let's...
All right.
Go hunt down some more of the IRA. And wipe that lot out. Except, right. except
go
Bobby
watch
Sands.
The sequel to this, The Foreigner, directed by Martin Campbell.
And go send Bobby Sands a sandwich, because poor bastard needs it. Yeah. You guys have no idea what I'm talking about.
No.
Yep.
All right, look up guys, well, I'm going to go ahead and say adios.
And I will say, take 5 and slide.
Sweet.
Thought you were going to say corporations suck. I was going to say, what, the corporation? So the ghost of Bob Hoskins would be after you.
The corporation sucks. The
corporation will look after you. Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to facebook.com. Type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.